From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point.
If you walk through the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon for the stealing knapsack.
Theme from The Wire there. Emmy nominations announced last week, and for the second year in a row, all four major broadcast networks were completely shut out of the Outstanding Drama category. That work, as everybody knows, has moved elsewhere, to dramas born in the world of cable. A new book looks at the TV revolution that saw those dramas emerge, and the minds behind The Sopranos, The Wire, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, and more. A conflicted, complicated breed. This hour On Point, the pioneers of a new golden age of television. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this the great art form of our time? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me in the studio today is Brett Martin, author of the terrific new book, Difficult Men. Behind the scenes of a creative revolution from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad, you can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Brett Martin, welcome. Great to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here.
Wonderful book, great story, great detail, and you write it so terrifically. But let me just put it out there right off the bat. Difficult Men? I mean, are there no women in this world that produced this revolution?
There are women throughout this book in incredibly important roles, as a matter of fact. There aren't enough of them. Women were both behind the scenes and in front of the camera an enormous part of this revolution. My title refers to the fact that the main shows that I write about were written by men primarily, and this new role of kind of all powerful showrunner was first seized upon by men, their subjects tended to be anti-heroes, different kinds of heroes than we'd ever seen
before.
Male
anti-heroes. Tony Soprano and all the rest.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, they're shows in many ways about what it means to be a man, about the negotiations between modernity and masculinity, and how we use male power and how men fight. And so,
in The Sopranos, in Breaking Bad, often in The Wire,
certainly right in Mad Men, which is the least sort of visceral fighting, but is really about how men go to combat. For better and for worse, that's been the dominant theme.
June Thomas from Slate is going to join us later on in the hour. She will help us look at this whole crew of women who are obviously working now. And we're going to talk about those. I mean, you're talking here about David Chase with The Sopranos, David Simon with The Wire, David Milch with Deadwood, Mad Men, right on down. And a TV revolution. Describe the revolution that you're pointing at. What was it? What are you defining?
Sometimes you can tell a revolution by how complete it is, by how you have to remind yourself how radical it was just at the beginning. In other words, we all sort of know this, that TV, within living memory, was the vast wasteland, was the boob tube. It was still a plausible point of pride to not own a television, mm-hmm. as recently as 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all know that adult storytelling somehow wound up going there, that instead that at some point in the last decade, we wound up talking not so much on Monday mornings about the films we'd seen over the weekend, not so much about this novel that captured everything about what America was going through, that really got to the heart of what was going on in the country, but about television shows. And so that's my book is about why and how that happened.
To the point, you say, that these shows, and I want you to define the kind of shows you're talking about, but that they are the new sort of signature American art form, I think are your words, of the first decade of the 21st century. And the showrunners, these creator, boss, visionary drivers of the shows, you're putting up there with Scorsese and Coppola and Updike and Philip Roth and Norman Mailer.
Right. It became the place where you went to ask the big questions or to have them asked and to discuss them and to be flummoxed by them and become engaged by what it means to be an American in this decade, whether the show took place in Deadwood in the 1800s or the 1960s in an ad company. That's where the big questions have been asked for the last 15 years. And these men, as has happened in, you know, wherever that dominant art form is, artists were ready to kind of rush in and take advantage of that opportunity.
Introduce us to some of those artists. I mean, they're names we know, and yet we don't. They're not as famous as
right.
Updike and Mailer. I mean, but they're out there. They didn't come out of nowhere. Many of them had been in television, been desperately frustrated in broadcast television.
Sure.
Suddenly, they've got this opportunity. What was the opportunity, and what's the type of person who rushed in to fill it? Introduce
right.
us to some of them.
Well, you know,
their quirks.
To begin with, I spent a lot of time in the book, as I think it should be, with David Chase, who is kind of, I call, the reluctant Moses of this golden age. David Chase was sort of your prototypical baby boomer who'd grown up worshiping film, worshiping the auteurs of European film and then of American film, as you point out, the Coppolas and Scorseses, mm-hmm. believed film was the higher calling and believed
he had, television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that he had somehow irretrievably corrupted himself by becoming successful. And he was quite successful in television.
As a TV writer.
As a TV writer and a good one. And mm-hmm. on shows that by any measure were something to be proud of. Certainly not the worst that TV
like
had.
What?
Well, Northern Exposure was mm-hmm. one that he ran. Mm-hmm. There was a show called I'll Fly Away, also by that great duo of Brandon Falsey, which was a mm-hmm. Really kind of, I mean, today on HBO, it was a show about the civil rights movement and something that you could easily see now being on HBO. And the Rockford Files, which, you know, for mm-hmm. all its kind of procedural silliness, was ahead of its time in some ways.
How did he come to be showrunner? Define what that means on HBO for The Sopranos.
Well, a showrunner, you know, the thing you have to understand about television is that, unlike any place else, the rarest of circumstances exist, which is that the writer has always been dominant on television. Writers who get...
As opposed to the director.
As opposed to
film.
The director. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's because television is a train that can never stop moving, and writers are the people who provide the coal.
Mm-hmm.
So even before this revolution, writers had an inordinate amount of power. And it usually rested in what became known as a showrunner, which is the head writer, sort of visionary of the show, the person who's sort of the keeper of the vision. And in some ways, as we move into the revolution that I'm talking about, becomes something that you can almost not talk about without using the words of the language of divinity. I mean, they really are the creator with a capital C.
These shows, Mad Men, The Sopranos,
exactly.
and so on. HBO had been known for putting on Hollywood films. And now
sure.
suddenly, late 90s, they're looking to put on dramas. What was driving that? And how did someone like David Chase end up in that godlike driver's seat?
Right. Well, I think HBO very reasonably looked at the world and looked at how we were getting movies in many different ways and thought, this isn't going to sustain us forever.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do is to brand ourselves. We need to be indispensable. You need to be considered culturally illiterate if you do not subscribe to HBO. And the way to do that, they determined, rightly, sort of brilliantly, was through original programming, was through empowering a writer, in this case, David Chase, a little bit before, and several before, Oz, which mm-hmm. was Tom Fontana's show, was a huge step on the way there. But that they said, we're going to basically, in a media landscape in which there's a billion choices, and that's only a slight exaggeration, we are going to come into being through original programming. And it was a wonderful sort of moment in which they had little to lose. They could take a big risk. David Chase had little to lose because he'd shopped this pilot everywhere to every network. And it was
the idea of a mob guy whose father had died, whose mother was a handful.
Right.
And an incredible amount of power and freedom handed to him in cable.
Right. All of a sudden, you know, it was the last stop because you didn't go to cable if you could avoid it. However, it came with this sudden autonomy, which he was, so frustrated and so fed up with network and his career that he was he thought, well, this is it. I'm going to pull out all the stops. I'm going to demand that this show is exactly as I want it to be. And the result. And thankfully, there were some enlightened executives there who let him do it. And we wound up with one of the great shows on television history.
It didn't have to be for a mass audience because it wasn't trying to sell the most soap. It didn't have to constrain its language or even its action.
Mm-hmm.
because it wasn't broadcast.
Right. You can't overestimate that first thing you said, which is that the key to this creative revolution is huge business changes, which no longer allow the specter of ratings to dominate every decision that gets made in television. That the fact that one could survive in the HBO model without the most number of viewers, without anything like what networks had once enjoyed, suddenly opened up vast amounts of freedom. And frankly, when it made the jump to basic cable, it was for many of the same reasons, and that same condition is what allowed great work to happen elsewhere.
Before you know it, the chains of broadcast television, if that's what they were, are off, and first season of The Sopranos, we're watching Tony Soprano strangle a man up close to death in practically real time, and we're in very new territory. Brett Martin writes about it in his wonderful new book, Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution, from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. The theme of Breaking Bad behind us right here. Vince Gilligan, showrunner there, created and produced. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the minds behind the rise of cable drama, the show creators who made TV drama great. With Brett Martin, his new book is Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution, from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is this the signature American art form of the 21st century so far? What was the show that hooked you, persuaded you? The Sopranos, The Wire, The Shield, Mad Men. What's your question about the minds, the men behind those shows? Brett Martin's with me in the studio. Here's an iconic scene from Season 1, Episode 13, Mad Men. Don Draper with a slide projector with a rotating slide wheel from Kodak.
Nostalgia literally means the pain from an old wound. It's a twinge in your heart, far more powerful than memory alone. This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine.
And we're out there, kind of in new territory. Brett Martin, yes, they were free of having to sell peanut butter.
Right.
There were only 13 shows in a season, as opposed to double that number in a broadcast television season. And yet there was that serial delivery here. You say it puts you in the mind of the old Victorian novelist, the sort of pressures that upside that the Dickens felt, that Trollope felt.
Sure, sure. No, I think that's become almost a cliche to compare these shows to novels, but in some ways that it's the closest, or to those serialized novels, it's the closest analog, in part because you begin not knowing where you're going to end, and you're sort of, it's this great creative leap of faith out into the void when you begin a show. You make a pilot, and a huge percentage of pilots never get made at all. And yet you have to lay in a certain amount of DNA there that's going to take you, if you're lucky, 4, 5, 6, 7 years down the line. It's one of the things that makes me that I argue makes television, in some ways, its own creative form. Not long films, not novels put on film, but rather a kind of fascinating creative process all its own.
And driven by an unusual breed of cat, with some remarkable actors in there. James Gandolfini in the news with his death recently. Here's one of the most remembered moments of Season 1 on HBO's The Sopranos. Tony Soprano, Gandolfini, may strike fear in the hearts of other men, but at the center of his own fears and torment is his mother, Livia, an extraordinary TV character played by Nancy Marchand.
Your wife never showed any interest in my jewels. She never complimented me on any of it, as I can remember.
You listen to me now. Before you do any more serious damage to yourself or your grandchildren's inheritance, you're going to stop living alone right now.
I'm not going to that nursing home.
Green Grove is a retirement community, and it's more like a hotel at Captain Teeb's.
Who's he?
Captain owns luxury hotels or something. I don't know. That's not the point. The point is, I talked to Mrs. DiCaprio over there, and she says she's got a corner suite available with a woods view. It's available now, but it's going to go fast.
Of course it's available. Somebody died.
Oh, Ma, you got to stop. You got to stop with this black poison cloud all the time, because I can't take it anymore.
Oh, poor you.
You'd be talking to a psychiatrist, too. And, of course, Tony Soprano does. You write wonderfully about James Gandolfini in this role at the beginning of your book, Difficult Men. Difficult Men, running these shows, also some handfuls for passionate actors. I wonder if you'd read a little bit from just the top of the book.
Sure. This is the very beginning. One cold winter's evening in January 2002, Tony Soprano went missing and a small portion of the universe ground to a halt. It did not come completely out of the blue. Ever since The Sopranos had debuted in 1999, turning Tony, anxiety-prone dad, New Jersey mobster, suburban seeker of meaning, into a millennial pop culture icon, the character's frustration, volatility, and anger had often been indistinguishable from those qualities of James Gandolfini, the actor who brought them to life. The role was a punishing one, requiring not only vast amounts of nightly memorization and long days under hot lights, but also a daily descent into Tony's psyche, at the best of times, a worrisome place to dwell, at the worst, ugly, violent, and sociopathic. Some actors, notably Edie Falco, who played Tony's wife Carmela Soprano, are capable of plumbing such depths without getting in over their heads. Blessed with a near photographic memory, Falco could show up for work, memorize her lines, play the most emotionally devastating of scenes, and then return happily to her trailer to join her regular companion Marley, a gentle yellow lab mix. Not so Gandolfini, for whom playing Tony Soprano would always require to some extent being Tony Soprano. Crew members grew accustomed to hearing grunts and curses coming from his trailer as he worked up to the emotional pitch of a scene by, say, destroying a boombox radio. An intelligent and intuitive actor, Gandolfini understood this dynamic and sometimes used it to his advantage. The heavy bathrobe that became Tony's signature, transforming him into a kind of domesticated bear, was murder under the lights in midsummer, but Gandolfini insisted on wearing it between takes. Other times, though, simulated misery became indistinguishable from the real thing, on set and off. In papers related to a divorce filing at the end of 2002, Gandolfini's wife described increasingly serious issues with drugs and alcohol, as well as arguments during which the actor would repeatedly punch himself in the face out of frustration. To anybody who had witnessed the actor's self-directed rage as he struggled to remember lines in front of the character, in front of the camera, he would berate himself in disgust, curse, smack the back of his own head. It was a plausible scenario.
Brett Martin reading from the opening of his new book, Difficult Men. Some great difficult actors there in James Gandolfini.
Sure.
Some great difficult showrunners. Describe some of these difficult personalities and how they wielded the tremendous power they had in these shows.
Right. Well, the point of this Gandolfini story is really, you know, how big a job these shows become, how much pressure winds up on the shoulders of everybody who is in charge of them, who sort of stewards them. And nobody gets more of that pressure than the showrunners, who really are, as I say, sort of masters of this universe. And don't forget they're writers, which is not necessarily the group of people you're most inclined to put in charge of what becomes a corporate division.
CEOs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, who would want that? But on the other hand, they're not schooled in management.
Not necessarily. They're not necessarily. You know, they're as neurotic as any other artist,
yeah.
And they're not necessarily inclined to be great managers, great collaborators. And so each of them has sort of developed their own adaptation to the needs of television in order to take advantage of the opportunity. And so you get a David Chase who again had come through television, but could be enormously prickly, fired writers with some frequency, was really an autocrat in the room. David Simon, who created The Wire, very different kind of person, but sort of created a laboratory of argument among the small group of writers who were creating Baltimore in the writer's room of The Wire. David Milch from Deadwood is a whole nother story altogether, which I'm not even sure.
Back in 19th century South Dakota.
Yeah. Yeah, and did it while lying on the floor, dictating his stream of consciousness into while being attended by a bunch of younger acolytes. They're all weird to some extent. Some are nicer than others, but it is a measure of what an enormous task it is to bring these universes to life.
Why do you think so many of them rushed to these characters who, as you say, were anti-heroes? They were dark. They were troubled, even almost crippled by personality and social defects, maybe. They did unspeakable things, get to Dexter, and pretty soon were carving people up. Why is that the kind of motif that really flowered here with this freedom?
Right. Well, I think on the one hand, it's just a way to say these were complicated, like real characters.
The TV is standard buffed up thing.
Right. White hats and black hats. You know, that's good writing. That's good characterization. I do think someone like David Chase, at the end of that clip that you played, Livia says, "Poor you." And that is absolutely directly quoted from his own mother. So some of this was playing out some of, their actual internal worldview. I also think that the audiences responded to it. You know, there was a moment when Tony strangled a guy on screen when HBO tried to pull out of it, said, "We can't do this. The audience won't accept this." Mm-hmm. And clearly we did. Thankfully they were enlightened enough to sort of let that happen. I think America around that time and was hungry for stories that were a little more complicated, had a sense of ill-ease itself on some level.
This is the decade of eventually War on Terror and all the rest.
Sure. And one in which we were in the political air was male power and how we were using it in the world. And, it was very much part of the political discourse.
George W. Bush.
Exactly. Were we men or were we, girls from France in how we interacted with the world? And this stuff was out there. And the desire to understand the monster outside and the monster inside was very much on Americans' minds, I think. And so you see these, and also what it meant, gender roles, at home. The men who made these shows had really lived through great dislocation in what it meant, what the role of a man was.
Women stepping up in lots of settings here and questions raised in the minds of some men.
Absolutely. So it becomes this act in some ways of wish fulfillment for both the creators. Both wish fulfillment and sort of queasy backing away from that wish fulfillment for both the actors and the creators and the audience.
Brett Martin is with us. His new book is Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution. And he's talking about the big dramas that came to define a lot of TV in the last decade and more. Let's go to our listener, Steve in New York City. Thanks for calling, Steve. You're on the air with Brett Martin.
Hi, Brett. Tom, how are you today?
Very well.
Good. I think that it's a wonderful story, but there's an historical aspect to it that also came into play. I was a television writer in the late 70s and early 80s, and in those days there was a strict firewall between television and film. If you were a television executive, if you were a television writer, you couldn't get a job writing film or working on the film side. But that wall came down in the 80s, and all of a sudden you started seeing every comedy root act that was ever on SNL got their own movie, got their own sequels. Then you got comic books. So these great writers who would have been film writers in the 60s and 70s had no choice but to go looking for a medium where they could express themselves.
Just wasn't there in film. What do you say, Brett?
Well, I think I it's interesting because ironically it went the other way. Early on in this period, the list of film actors who were not allowed by their agents to go audition for some of the greatest roles in TV history is long. That stigma has complete both for writers and for actors clearly has fallen, and for actors it's become, and particularly for female actors who have fewer and fewer satisfying roles available to them in film. It's become known as the place you want to work, but that's a pretty wholesale change.
Wholesale change, and here they were ready to jump in. I mean, desperate to jump in, almost self-loathing many of them because of their earlier years in TV work, and here in a new realm. Michael in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of a lot of the programs that have been referenced already. Huge fan, particularly of the writing. So much so that in the case of Deadwood, I've often watched on DVD with the subtitles on because the writing is just so rich and the rhythm of the writing, so you can just get wrapped up in it. But one thing I wanted to get the author's thoughts on was some of the precursors that took place on network TV. Really, like in the 80s, and I'm thinking back to shows like Saint Elsewhere, which was set in Boston, and Hill Street Blues, where you had kind of traditional television drama settings, police and hospitals, but you had complex characters, at least by the standards of the time. And, you know, sort of there was some moral ambiguity around some of the characters, and some of them were actually kind of unappealing, and yet they were still sort of the stars. And I was just curious if you saw a relationship between, you know, the people trying to stretch the envelope a bit back then and, you know, what led to the programming on the premium channels.
Michael, I appreciate your call. Brett Martin, I know you do. You look back to a first golden age of TV in the early 50s, the 50s, and then exactly to these kind of shows in the 80s.
That's right. I do. I begin, you know, I call this the third golden age, and I do identify the second golden age as this flowering that exactly your caller is talking about. Largely, the two shows he cites were under the umbrella of a place called MTM Enterprises and a man called Grant Tinker, who really ran it as a proto HBO, where he empowered writers, and you have a great sort of flowering of work then, and a lot of the men, of course, David Milch began on Hill Street Blues, which led to NYPD Blue, and you know it's not a surprise that a lot of people from that era wound up on cable.
So here they were they surprised by the public response? Were they saying, we knew all along if we could just let it rip, say anything, show everything, we'd have the audience, or not?
I think it was a great joy. You know, they fell upon this stuff with the kind of hunger of starving men in many ways. I think there was a great amount of vindication for somebody like Chase, who had been told repeatedly, oh, you're too dark. You know, it's a great show, but you're too dark. And certainly it caught a lot of business people by surprise, and they rushed to catch up and sort of join in this new world.
Our caller talks about Deadwood and what putting reading the subtitles here. Here's a little from Deadwood. Showrunner was David Milch.
Pain or damage don't end the world, or despair, or beatings. The world ends when you're dead. Until then, you got more punishment in store. Stand it like a man and give some back.
It's not exactly the Brady Bunch.
I was going to say, what a lovely sentiment for the morning. David Milch is one of the more bizarre characters, and that language, you know, which everybody talks about at Deadwood is actually how the man talks.
Lying on his floor, dictating.
In any context, yeah. Okay. So, certainly that is not a tone and sensibility that you would have seen on television more than, you know, 10 years ago.
Is the golden age still on?
Well, that's the open question. I think that it's been proven that hunger for storytelling does exist. I think that will have a home in this ever-expanding number of options we have. We seem to have passed a kind of exhilarating, you know, first phase in which it, you know, everything seemed new and fresh. But I'm looking forward to what network finds it necessary to take a desperate risk next.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the minds behind the rise of cable drama, the show creators, showrunners who made TV drama great. Brett Martin is with us. He's author of the new book, Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution, from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. Behind us right here, the theme from Orange is the New Black. Regina Spektor performing the theme song for Netflix's newest hit, Orange is the New Black, created by woman Jenji Kohan. We'll talk about that in a moment. You can join us. What about the women, their creations? What about all these men? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Here's a little bit from Orange is the New Black, brand spanking new original production, getting great reviews. Piper Chapman, played by Taylor Schilling, has just arrived at prison on the Netflix show and meets one of her roommates, Nikki Nichols, played by Natasha Lyonne.
Look at you, Blondie. What'd you do?
Aren't you not supposed to ask that question? I read that you're not supposed to ask that.
You read that? Well, you studied for prison?
The women are working it, too. June Thomas joins us in just a moment here. Lots of feedback. Britt Martin on Facebook here. Todd says, I'm tired of the anti-hero trope. Every new cable show since The Sopranos seems obligated to follow the same model. Difficult, white, middle-class male with a dark side. The exceptions like Enlightened are brilliant but don't survive.
Right.
Wendy writes, since there's no reference to female characters, I find it difficult to believe this is the best we can do, but Unter writes to us, parallel point. The female characters in the shows you're talking about are also well-written. The women characters in Breaking Bad, Mad Men are deep. This strengthens the male roles. Even the housewife's mundane life is given an edge. It's nice to see roles that are not shallow in filling the old Hollywood trite or obvious types usually allotted to actresses right there. So even it works. June joins us in a second, but even before we get there, what about women and their roles in the shows you're focused
on?
Right.
Well, if it's possible to agree with all of those emails, I would like to do so, because it's absolutely true that there has been, as always happens in television, a certain imitation sets in and a certain fatigue after a while sets in. I do agree 100% that the female roles in these shows, despite being somewhat overshadowed, have been among the most complicated, accomplished on the part of the actresses, and well-rounded and exciting roles that, you know, and I could name, you know, whether it's Carmela Soprano, Peggy Olson, Skyler White. The opportunities have been there for those roles as well, and in part because the writers' rooms are filled with women, as they should be, and because, you know, the more voices, the better. So I do think you know, absolutely, we may have reached the end of the anti-hero as the primary and in some ways only model.
Brett Martin, stand by. June Thomas. Joins us right now from Brooklyn, culture critic for Slate Magazine. June Thomas, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
You've written directly on this theme, saying enough with the TV anti-heroes already. What about the women working in this genre, June, and the shape, tenor, heroes, anti-heroes of the shows they put out?
Yeah, I think there are, you know, as Brett was just saying, we've become tired with seeing the same things over and over. And I think the TV networks are cottoning on to that. There's been a whole spate of shows where the auteurs, these extraordinary people with singular visions, are female. You mentioned Jenji Kohan from Orange is the New Black, which I think is an amazing show because it seems so refreshing. It's almost completely populated by women, women of color, different kinds of women, different ages, different backgrounds, and that feels so exciting. That shouldn't be so strange, but it is. Lena Dunham from Girls. In Brett's book, he talks about how women tended to be kind of relegated to half-hour shows, things like Nurse Jackie, Weeds, United States of Tara, Enlightened. But Girls is a half-hour show, but it's very much her vision, her strange view of life. And also, it's interesting to me that she comes from a very different background. She's very young. She didn't have a background writing on other TV shows, on networks. This just came you know, fully formed, yeah, it seemed, out of her head.
Let's compare and contrast a little bit. Lena Dunham, of course, both the showrunner and the lead character in HBO's Girls. We've got a scene here, June, Brett, where Dunham's character, Hannah Horvath, is told by her parents they will no longer support her in New York City as she tries to write a book. She's talking with her mother, here played by Becky Ann Baker. Hannah protests their decision.
I could be a drug addict. Do you realize how lucky you are? I mean, it doesn't have to be heroin. It could be something more insidious, like pills, which are legal and which a lot of kids do all the time. And then slowly, they become totally useless. They seem really high-functioning and then it just ruins them. Okay, my friend Sophie, her parents don't support her. Last summer, she had 2 abortions, right in a row. And no one came with her.
What does that have to do with anything?
I'm just saying that I am so close to the life that I want, the life that you want for me, that for you to just end that right now?
No more money.
Lena Dunham and Becky Ann Baker there in Girls. I mean, Brett, what about the women in direct, not just show running, but in Lena's case, acting, sure, in this world?
Well, I think, I mean, that clip is a perfect example of a voice that is just as idiosyncratic and honest and new and exciting as any of the men that that I write about. I do think it's an interesting chauvinism of the clock that they still women's shows still, although I guess Orange is the New Black is close to an hour, still wind up in what gets framed in our world as a kind of a sitcom, length at least.
30 minutes.
30 minutes
of the hour
is what I mean,
that
you're
focused, the hour-long stuff you're focused on.
But yeah, and I think that June's point is absolutely correct that, you know, part of what allowed Lena to start doing this from scratch is that she was born in an era when there was no, I mean, she's so young that she essentially was raised on The Sopranos, which is the point I make. And so that the world has changed so completely that to have a vision and to want to bring that vision to television is almost a natural.
June, Brett, let me bring in Ellen calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to say that since you're starting to talk about those female characters and that Orange is the New Black has some amazing characters, and especially that the central character, Piper, is one of the first, you know, main characters that's a bisexual woman. And I hope that they really explore that more in the second season, and that they also have a really developed transgender character. These are really groundbreaking roles. So I think it's a great series, and I really love that whoever is developing these characters is really thinking about diversity. It's got a tremendous a range of racial representation as well. So it's great.
Right there in the women's prison. Ellen, thanks for your call. June Thomas, how about it? Orange is the New Black, Jinji Cohen, showrunner there. What about its material, its characters? And what about Jinji Cohen among the kind of showrunners that Brett's describing? Would she fit in with that posse, or is she different?
Well, I think what we're seeing with Orange is the New Black, and I agree completely with Ellen on everything she said about the show, both in its quality and just the how exciting it is to see this range of characters and people. And Jinji Cohen has her background in Weeds, where, again, she was writing about white people coming into contact with and being changed by people who are different from them, sometimes that being about race. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that Orange is the New Black, which extraordinarily, because of Netflix and because of, you know, the way that shows can be as long as they need to be, those shows are all at least 60 minutes. I mean, that's a full 20 minutes longer than your average broadcast network show. But I also think I'm seeing more and more shows. I'm kind of being surprised. You know, we're seeing the fracturing of television, so many different networks, so many different kinds of programming. You know, ABC Family, there's this show, The Fosters, which is executive produced.
We're losing June right there. Brett, do you know the show The Fosters?
I'm afraid I don't. No, I've actually missed both from having to catch up during the period of writing the book, and then I've been on tour. Well, I have not even seen Orange is the New Black yet, I'm afraid.
But things move fast in this.
I do, and that's, you know, it is. It's a constant stream, and it's very inconvenient that they keep making television. I would say that my suspicion, you know, I think it's refreshing to hear everything that both the caller and June was just saying about what Orange is the New Black is. You know, my suspicion is also that it's really well written and really well made. And I think that's probably still, you know, the hunger for quality, is more than any necessarily, genre is is tantamount.
I mean, you write about how the cable venue format really changed what could be television drama. Now we're into Netflix, and you write about how the improvement in the physical television and the quality of the images on the screen, the size of those images, also a big deal in making things more cinematic. Now a lot of people, you see plenty of people, young people in particular, watching on quite small screens, and at the same time we've got Netflix and so many ways of delivery. Where does the continuing evolution of the format and the presentation take the drama?
Well, I think that that what the Emmys this week made official is what we all sort of knew, which is that that the distinction between these various delivery systems is almost completely broken down at this point. Somebody born today wouldn't know the difference between a television program and a streaming program. And what that does for us is give us an ever increasing number of channels, in quotes, which have the incentive to bring themselves into being by putting on interesting work.
Mm. Let's go to Patty calling from Lebanon, Tennessee. Patty, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. And I haven't heard it mentioned, but The Killing, which is on AMC, where the lead character, her name is Sarah, and she is, it's a cop show, you know. It's a very dark show, but it's set in very green area of our country, the Seattle area, and just the whole setting of it, and they play off of the rain in Seattle, you know, and it's just the whole thing of it is so beautiful, and yet she is the strongest character, the most troubled character, the character with a background that understands how people get into the whole criminal area.
Is she the Tony Soprano of the show, or the Antonia Soprano?
She is a policeman, but she is the Tony Soprano of that show. And it and the way the format of the show is, they start with the name of the show is The Killing, so they start it the season with a murder. And then the entire season is the investigation of that murder. And so the character development during the season is very well done for all of the people who are. It's not just a one-hour show where you get to kind of know each of the characters that are affected by the murder.
Right, but she's got a kind of dark character, even though she's the police investigator here. June Thomas is the anti-hero trope, going to come right into, women's world here as well.
Well, I think we certainly have seen complicated characters. I mean, Hannah Horvath from Girls, the clip that you played earlier, she's not nice. You know, she's...
Yep.
Conflicted. Certainly the cop at the center of The Killing. And also, it's interesting to me, The Killing and The Bridge, which has just started on FX, both a show run by women. The Bridge also has a co-male showrunner. Both come from Scandinavia. And I wonder if that's relevant. The women who are at the center of the investigations are flawed or are difficult, are traumatized by their work. And I think that's it's relevant. It seems to be an evolution of the male anti-hero trope, and I find it very interesting.
And let me ask you, Brett is bold in his assertion that this kind of TV drama is the signature American art form of the first decade of the 21st century. He puts these showrunners up in the company of Scorsese and Altman and Francis Coppola, and not just them, but, Updike and Roth and Mailer, and not just them, but Dickens and George Eliot and Trollope. What about that tier for this work and these auteurs, these artists?
I agree that these are extremely accomplished authors, creators who require and deserve all kinds of credit, all kinds of respect. I don't know if we can talk of one signature genre, one signature type of art. I do think that there are many different kinds of wonderful art. I do think, too, that television has one flaw, which is that it is not particularly international. We are seeing some of these Scandinavian dramas come. We, of course, have the British dramas. But I would like to see more international influences. I also think that we shouldn't completely overlook broadcast shows. I mean, shows that get audiences multiples larger than the shows that we've been talking about for most of this hour, there's a great skill in creating those. They are the film business goals, which I think we should also give respect to. I mean, it takes a great deal of talent to make 24 episode seasons, and I think when those do work, I think of shows like The Good Wife on CBS, mm-hmm. which is both a, you know, churns them out, but churns out really high quality, has wonderful actors, wonderful stories. That also deserves a lot of credit.
Brett, we've just got a minute here. Where do you see broadcast television going? Because after all, by no means does everyone get these pay-to-view cable shows.
Sure, and I agree there's been throughout this period, good work on network, particularly in comedy, where the broadcast networks have managed to sort of take more risks and keep more interesting shows on the air, and keep up with cable in some ways. That said, they have a real problem, which is that the numbers that they need to survive in their business model are harder and harder to get, and it sort of naturally leads down the path of the lowest common denominator, and I'm not sure what's going to fix that.
Is that market always there? Does that somehow change with streaming and everything else? Does broadcast TV ever
If I could answer your question, I hope I'd be hired by CBS, but I don't know what they're going to do. I know that they're wringing their hands about it, though.
It's just been great to have you. And you too, June. June Thomas with Slate Magazine, culture critic there, joining us today from Brooklyn, New York. June, thank you very much for joining us in this hour. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Brett Martin, his new book is Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. We just got a couple of seconds. What's your favorite right now these days, Brett, in this room?
Without saying favorite, I'm extremely excited for Breaking Bad to come back in a couple of weeks.
Well, we'll be watching for that. Brett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll go out with Nick Lowe singing The Beast in Me from the pilot episode of HBO's The Sopranos. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The beast in me is caged by frail and fragile bars, restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me.